Good morning, everyone. Hope today has been profitable and relaxing for you. To get set up here. It's amazing, things have really changed. A few years ago, I would have just come up with some notes, and now it's technology. Sometimes the technology works, sometimes it doesn't. Hopefully it will work here this morning. So I want to take you on a thought journey this morning. That's a way of saying I'm going to break every rule of PowerPoint that you have probably heard of, and if you haven't heard of them, I'm going to break them this morning. And hopefully it'll be interesting for you. If not, we'll wake you up for the next song. I want to talk about something that I think is really important. As we leave the Feast of Tabernacles, you always have that sermon or that message that says we're about to go back out into the world, and it's a little bit of a downer. But I hope to convey a message of hope and purpose this morning. We've had several days where we've been able to enjoy the feast. We've been able to experience God's goodness in a unique way. We've been able to spend more time, get closer to Him, spend time and create relationships. And it's reflective of the future. For a time 1,000 years where people, where humankind will be able to engage with God in a way that they haven't been able to en masse. Time of hope and joy and purpose. So that's for 1,000 years. But at the end of that time, something happens. So for 1,000 years, there's no more pain, there's no more suffering, there's no more sickness, there's no more war. And then there is. There is. We read in Revelation 20, verses 7 through 9, and then when the 1,000 years were completed, Satan will be released from his prison, and he will go out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to assemble them for battle, whose number is like the sand of the sea. And they went up on the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the fortified camp of the saints and the beloved city, and fire came down from heaven and consumed them. Wow. After experiencing God's goodness, His way of life, His perfection, something happened. What happened? A few observations we can make here. The first is the term deceived. It's really interesting. In the Greek, the underlying thought process there is wandering. You're led astray. They wandered off the path. You know, one of the things that I want to ask God in the kingdom is, how much did Satan really do? Does he poke and we wander off? Or is it some like mass horrendous deception? Or is it a slow movement? A slow changing? But something happened. And the people forgot the perfection and the goodness that they had experienced, to the point to where all over the earth, and it's really interesting, across the four corners of the earth, it wasn't one group, it wasn't one place, it was across the earth. And they came to array in battle. And the King of Kings is at Jerusalem. And they were still willing to come fight. How could this happen? I'd like to delve into that just a little bit, but I'd also like to consider another question as we move forward. What about us? Because we're at the end of the feast, which is a foretaste of the millennium. And we're about to go out. How do we think about where we are? How do we think about our connection to our Father? I'd like to spend a few minutes on, I think, one of the things that we see in the world at large, and that's epistemic chaos. Now, this is a term, you may have come across it, you see it in social analysis, you see it in political analysis, it's being discussed by researchers, by scholars. Epistemic chaos. Epistemic comes from the Greek word episteme, which means knowledge, understanding, science. It's also a Greek verb, estepimei, which refers to know or to understand. So the idea here is epistemic communicates this idea that we know something that we can stand firm on. There's a justification. There's a process. It's not just that we know it. There is a standard of values and a process that we've gone through, and the knowledge that we have, we can stand firm on. We know it. So you can imagine what epistemic chaos is then. There are different definitions, slightly worded. But it's a profound disorder. It's a rupture in the thought process. And it's a breakdown in how knowledge is created, how we come up with it, how we validate it, how we share it within a society and in a community. Now again, we're not going to see the term epistemic in the Bible. We'll see some terms about knowledge similar to that, but we're not going to find this term. This is a term that the world is talking about and what's happening in the world. So what does it look like when we're in a situation of epistemic chaos? It's not just about having different opinions. There have been different opinions forever. We're always going to have different opinions. But when we find epistemic chaos, it's when the very foundations that we use to determine truth and error, right and wrong, they begin to crumble. They begin to change. Now, there are a lot of reasons for it, and there's causal factors for everything in life. Here are a few. I'm not going to go through it. I think the first one is probably the most poignant, information overload. You know, in 1989, Richard Werfer wrote a book called Information Anxiety. And he noted, this was 30 years ago, there was more information in one Sunday edition of the New York Times than a person that lived in the 19th century would encounter in their entire life. That's 30 years ago. Today, it's estimated that the average person consumes 34 gigabytes of information a day, and that's all non-work. Work just adds to that. How do we think about consuming that information? How do we think about filtering that information in our life to determine what we think about truth, to determine what we think about error, what's right and wrong? You know, you think about some of these other causal factors that lead to this type of chaos. You have a redefinition of categories. We'll touch base on that in just a minute. Create distrust in authorities, competing voices. Who can determine the basis or the standard of knowledge? It also leads to community fragmentation. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. Does anybody feel this today? Do you feel like we experience this today? The problem is not just that we feel this. The church is not immune to what happens in the world. And everything that I've told you, the scholars are talking about, the sociologists are talking about, the politicians are talking about, this impacts us. The Bible does have something to say about this, but I want to say, as we step into this, because there are some points I think we need to make, this is not unique to this time. There's been knowledge chaos in the past. If we think about, I want to put a couple of scriptures here together for us to think about. And as we're going through this, I want you to think about, what is God's expectation for you and I? And has that expectation of his people changed throughout history? So look at Daniel's prophecy. So Daniel had received a prophecy. He prayed. He was given part of an understanding of that prophecy. And then the angel told him, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and the knowledge shall increase." Now, we normally look at this from a perspective of scriptural knowledge. And clearly, we know more specifically about the prophecies that Daniel was given than he did, because we have the ability to have hindsight, right? So we can look back and we can see some of that prophecy fulfilled. But it's not just about prophecy. Knowledge is increasing everywhere. And people are going to and fro. There's new opinions, new ideas, new knowledge, new information. 34 gigabytes a day that we're consuming. But if we put that together with a warning that Isaiah gave us. And it's interesting, the warning that Isaiah gave, which is to those people who should know, his warning was not just to the world at large. The first part of Isaiah 5, there's an owner that plants a vineyard, and he cares for the vineyard, and he hedges it about, and he wants beautiful fruit. Near the end of Isaiah, we read this warning: "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight." Again, this is to those who should know. Those who should have a strong foundation, who should be connected to God. But somehow, they let other knowledge come in, and they allowed that to get changed. And what's interesting here, this is a Hebrew literary technique. It's not just talking about redefinition. It's talking about inversion. It's talking about an order that conflicts with God's order. Something has been changed. Something is adjusted. And it conflicts with the way that God has ordered life. And God is a God of life. Right? His order is to produce life. But again, this is not unique to this time. We can look at Galatians 1:6. What does Paul tell the Galatians? "I am astonished that you have left the gospel so soon." What does Titus say? "There are wolves in sheep clothing that have entered in." What about Colossians? Paul was combating Jewish mysticism, asceticism, all kinds of beliefs that had come in and were beginning to confuse the people, and they were beginning to accept something else. But what is our challenge? Is it not new to the people of God? God's expectation has never changed, regardless of what the situation is on the outside. His expectation of his people is to live a brilliant, successful, hope-filled life reflecting of his values. Regardless of where we live and the time. Let me talk to the young people for just a minute. Actually for everybody, but more targeted to the young. You know, there are times when we can look and we can think, oh, it's all doom and gloom. The end is coming. This life is not about doom and gloom. This life is about living a hope-filled, value-driven life that is firmly connected to your Father. And if that is the case, he will lift you up. Get your education. Develop your skills. Build your family. Build careers. That's the expectation that our Father has. And quite frankly, that's his expectation regardless of where we are in our life. He has not given us a spirit of fear. He's given us a spirit of power. And he wants his people's light to shine regardless of the time. But how do we do that? So, if you forget everything else in the sermon today, please remember this. Do not just make room for God in your life. In my 60 years in the church, 60 seems to be a big number. Several other speakers, we're all getting older. But in my 60 years in the church, the one thing that I've noticed is when people go out and they build their life and they determine what they're going to do, and then they come back to God and say, hey, got a little place here for you. Got another place here. You can have this. That ends up in all kinds of problems. God is not interested in pieces and parts. What I would encourage is us to take a completely different approach to God. I would encourage us to completely build our life around him. Put him at the absolute center. So I'd like to spend a little bit of time, the time we have remaining, and I want to look at a pattern God used with Israel. And that's the construction of the camp. Because there are some really powerful principles that were involved in the structure of the camp that we should take away and we should look use in our own lives. But we see this pattern. We see other people that have used the similar pattern in their own lives to great success. So let's look at the camp as a model for life. Starting in Numbers chapter 2, verse 2, we read something interesting. It says, and the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, every one of the children of Israel shall camp by his own standard beside the emblems of his father's house, and they shall camp some distance from the tabernacle of meeting. Now, the way the camp was constructed, you had the tabernacle in the center, you had the Levites surrounding the tabernacle along with the priests, Moses and Aaron, and then you had the 12 tribes arrayed around that. The Levites were in the middle so that the people wouldn't inadvertently come into the wrong space without knowing. It was there as a safety marker. But it's interesting, if you look at the Hebrew, and I think the ESV identifies this well, it's not just that they were around the tabernacle. They were facing it. Their tents opened up to the tabernacle. So just think for a second. These were people that had just come out of Egypt. They had lost connection with the Sabbath. God had to be very specific and teach them which day the Sabbath was, how they were to keep the Sabbath. And so what God is doing to the people, doing with the people, by giving them his laws, by structuring the way that they were interacting with them, with him, he was teaching them what it meant to have a relationship with him. How to have that successful relationship. They lost that connection. And that is embedded in the way that he structured the camp. I'll look at two things. The first is we're going to look at his constant presence. Because the way that God structured the camp and the people's daily routines, they were in persistent connection with him. Persistent contact. The other one thing I want to look at briefly is a theme we see throughout the Bible, and that's living in the light. Because we have a visceral example of God. And his word, his way of life, his presence, quite frankly, is what cuts through the chaos. So if you're wondering how to navigate the epistemic chaos of this world, he's how you do it. His light. And we see a visceral example of that. Let's spend just a couple of minutes on his constant presence. Let's think about what this would have meant to an ancient mind. So you're in the middle of the wilderness, in the middle of the desert. Your tent is facing the tabernacle. By day, you have the pillar of cloud. By night, you have the pillar of fire. What is the first thing you see when you get up in the morning? The pillar. What is the last thing you see as you turn in and go to bed? I mean, it is completely dark. You don't have any lights. You have the pillar of fire. And that is the last thing you see before you go into your tent. Constant connection. What about the daily offerings? You're in the camp, again, you're in the middle of the wilderness. What do you see? You get up in the morning, you have the morning sacrifice, that permeates the camp, and you see the billowing cloud coming up from the sacrifice. You can smell it. It's visceral. His presence is there. What do you see in the evening? What about your normal daily activity? As you're walking about the camp, what is always present? He is. What if you walk away? What if you go out and you're hunting in the desert and you get lost? What do you look for? The pillar of cloud. That's your navigational anchor. That's where home is. That's where you're safe. Even camp movement. When the cloud moved, the people moved. If you think about what that would have meant to an ancient person, their entire existence was connected to him constantly. So what about us? How do we think about this? A quick question. How do we start the end, the beginning, and the end of our day? We have two examples. There are others, but two. We have Daniel in Daniel 6, verses 10, where it says, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since the early days. Not something that he did. Now, I think we all know the story. I'm not going to get into it. There's a prohibition against praying to anyone else except the king. Didn't matter to Daniel. God was his anchor. God was his foundation. That's what he was tied to. Three times a day, he created the process in his own life to come into constant connection with God. It was intentional. He built his life around God. He didn't look just to say, hey, God, got a few minutes over here. Do you mind if we just kind of connect here? No. It was intentional. What about David? Evening and morning and at noon, I will pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice. Another question, something for us to consider. Is God central to our activities and our discussions? You know, Malachi, it's a really interesting statement. Malachi 3:17, then those who feared the Lord spoke to one another, and the Lord listened and heard them. So a book of remembrance was written before him for those who fear the Lord and who meditate on his name. You know, when we come to services, Holy Day tomorrow, what are we talking about? What are we thinking about? What conversations do we have? Are we using our conversations to constantly tie us back to his presence in our life? Deuteronomy, something that was referenced earlier in the feast. Deuteronomy 6. And these words which I have commanded you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk about them when you sit in the house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. So just think about that for a second. It's pervasive. Everything that we do should be structured in our life so that we have connection points to him. Is that the way that we have structured our life? Or do we look for a little place that he can simply feel? Phil. light and darkness. Light versus darkness is a theme that we have seen, that we see throughout the Bible. And I think it deserves a little bit of focus here. We think about light in Scripture. It's more than just illumination. It represents God's active presence in his power to bring order out of chaos. We see on a consistent basis darkness and chaos aligned. It's contrary to God's order of life. And his word, the word that he gave, that gives us, the word that he gave Israel, the scriptures and the law, helps us learn how to live within his order so that we can be aligned to his order, not aligned to chaos and darkness. Just think about this. Genesis chapter 1, verses 3 through 4. You know, it's interesting. In verse 1 and 2, what was the condition of the earth? Chaos and confusion. Tohu and bohu. It couldn't support life. What was the first thing that God did? He introduced light. He introduced his order, and he began separating it as a part of his reclamation process that we see in Colossians 1 to begin to separate the light and the dark, to begin to put in his order. What do we see through the rest of Genesis 1 and through Genesis 2? We see him establishing order that can produce what? Life. John also has something interesting to say, talking about Christ. It says, in him was life, and the life was the light of man, and the light shined in the darkness, and the darkness didn't comprehend it. They're so different. Darkness and chaos cannot understand God's order. So if we leave the light and go to the dark, we lose our mooring. We need to stay connected to the light to understand his order. We look at Revelation 22, verse 5, where it says, talking about New Jerusalem, there shall be no night there. There shall be no need for a lamp or light of the sun, for the Lord gives them light. It's talking about more than illumination, because darkness no longer exists. There is only light and life. So what about us? How do we think about this? Again, let's tie it back to epistemic chaos and the chaos that's out there. How do we maintain our connection to God? How do we make sure that we can fulfill his will, that we can live a brilliant life aligned to his values, incredibly successful, honoring and glorifying him? How do we do that? What standard do we use in our life? What value system? What do we use to help us filter through all the additional knowledge, through all the things that are coming out? Those 34, 35, how many gigabytes it is now, coming into us. So what filter do we use? And in Psalm 119, 105, it says, your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. It should be the filter that we use to sift through everything that we're getting. We should be tied in to the scripture, which brings another point. Do we know the scripture? Not just what other people say about it. But we could add to this. Where do we get our knowledge? Where do we get our information? Is there another organization? Is there another group? Is there somewhere that we get our knowledge other than God's word that we expect to help us cut through the chaos and the darkness? Because if there is, it might be good to rethink that. Christ was pretty clear in John 8. Then Jesus said to those Jews who believed him, again, for those who believe, if you abide in my word, You are my disciples indeed. And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. The truth will allow us to navigate the chaos and live the kind of life that God expects. So as we leave the feast, come to the end, the question I guess maybe we should be asking is, how will we approach our life with God? How do we think about that? Will we just make room for him? Will we kind of figure out what we're going to do and give him the pieces and parts? Or we take a different approach? We go back and build our life around him so we have constant connection, so that his light guides us through the chaos of life, and we can shine brilliantly his nature into the world.